If it please the court, Kathy Gowdy, Alternate Defense Counsel, Colorado 28436. This case involved a large number of mistakes in which that were properly objected to, but which the trial court overrid the rules of procedure that govern trials. It also created a new inference in evidence that is improper, and I'm asking the court to reverse on its admission of expert testimony that is guised as Rule 701 lay testimony. The analysis to 702 does not come into play in this case because the district attorney did not endorse the policeman as an expert and also failed to try to qualify him at trial. He simply asked the expert question of the policeman based on your training and experience, which he had previously testified to in great detail, what is your opinion? At that point, it was an expert opinion being queried, and the defendant properly objected to it. The court, however, overruled it and allowed the testimony to come in. The testimony was not, as the people argue, cumulative. The only other statement as to the amount of this being for use as a sale, as product, came from Mr. Escobar, who under oath did not testify the same as he had when the police testify. And that is an interesting point when you read through all of the transcripts and the testimony, is that under oath and granted immunity, which should be the strongest standard we have for truthfulness, Mr. Escobar said Mr. Almasermanid was not involved. He didn't know about it, it wasn't his, and that is under oath with immunity where he can speak safely. However, they chose to impeach him with a statement made at the scene and then again at the police station to police where he was trying to basically save his butt and say, oh, it was his, I didn't know anything about it. But under oath, he said, my uncle didn't know anything about it.
Was the impeaching testimony objected to?
I don't believe it was.
So all the testimony came in. Two different versions of what Mr. Escobar said, and doesn't the jury have the right to believe whichever version they find more credible?
They do, but my issue is that this evidence is not cumulative. It was a bolstering evidence by the policeman to support Mr. Escobar's statement.
Counsel, let me parse this a little more finely if I can. I understand your position here is that Escobar
was the nephew.
The nephew testified that the uncle didn't know anything about it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, strictly speaking, that is not the same point as this amount of marijuana is for resale. And isn't that, or is consistent with resale, isn't that the thrust of the police officer's testimony?
The police officer's testimony was, yes, this was to be resale. It is consistent, however, it's improper because it's expert testimony, because he's basing it on his training experience and not on lay. There is a great deal of argument in the people's brief that obviously 7 pounds and 7 bricks, whatever, would be an amount, but that doesn't need to be told to the jury. If the people wanted to put in an expert to reinforce what people might already guess and infer this was, then they should have endorsed him 30 days before trial as an expert.
But if everybody knows that 7 pounds of marijuana is consistent with resale, why isn't that proper lay opinion then? It doesn't require special training or expertise.
Because we don't know everybody knew that. We're inferring that they knew it based. We're all guessing. And when the officer gets up and takes the speculation out and it's an expert opinion, he needs to have been endorsed, his CV provided, and they need to have had notice in case they had an expert to rebut. That is how expert procedure works.
Oh, let's assume for the sake of argument that the prosecution just wants to elicit lay opinion. What would be, in your view, the proper procedure for doing that?
For lay opinion, he could have said there were 7 pounds that we would confiscate it and left it at that, wrapped in individual duct tape packages. Let the jury draw their own inferences.
Oh, no, I'm asking, what would be the proper procedure, in your view, for admitting the opinion that 7 pounds is consistent with resale?
You endorse the policeman as an expert within Rule 16, at least 30 days before trial, which permits the defendant to perhaps have a Shrek hearing.
I gather from your answer that you believe that under no circumstances could that be admitted as lay opinion.
Only if the defendant failed to object and it was harmless and cumulative, but in this case that didn't occur.
So there's no way to properly admit that as lay opinion?
No, there isn't. It's expert.
Does any case say that?
I believe the Stewart case went into a great deal of analysis. The Colorado Supreme Court 2002 case went into analysis of going into training and experience. Is expert, it then it becomes 702.
Well, I'm asking on the specific question of, is there any case saying that the opinion that a certain amount of marijuana, it would be, you could infer that it's for resale. Is there any case that says that opinion cannot be admitted as lay opinion testimony?
No, there isn't, because it would be, the amount goes case by case. It could have been, had Mr. Escobar testified, had he been in a heavy Rastafarian, for example, it was personal use. Personal use goes case by case, so I don't think any case would say that. So in this case, he is jumping to the one issue they needed for the conspiracy. And the conspiracy in this case was that Mr. Almacenero was in the back seat of a car and there were seven bricks of pot in the back seat. So
I think Judge Loeb's question was a little more general. It was really, or at least it's my question, is there some authority, one way or the other, as whether an officer can testify that a significant quantity, a large quantity of marijuana, is most likely for resale as opposed to for personal use, without 7 pounds being the specific amount?
No.
No, okay.
No, there isn't. If there was, I would have heard it from every district attorney I'm trying cases. No, there is not. And that, in fact, is why many policemen now are being trained as drug recognition experts and endorsed as experts, so they can come in and say that at trial.
Well, isn't the governing test about whether it's lay opinion versus expert opinion the question basically whether ordinary citizens could be expected to know this information?
Yes.
Okay. Well, at some point, a certain amount of marijuana is going to be within the realm of ordinary citizens. Ordinary citizens know that certainly 100 pounds of marijuana is consistent with resale. So why can't ordinary citizens be expected to know that 7 pounds of marijuana is consistent with resale?
I think I'm going to parse the issue a little more. They can be, and they could infer that, but the people do not have the right to put a witness on to say that, that is not endorsed as an expert. That's what I'm saying here.
Okay.
It's a 701, and he's supposed to testify from his own perceptions.
Let me ask you some questions about your cumulativeness argument. As I understand it, there were really two statements that are at issue, at least on appeal. I'm not sure. One was this testimony about inferring that this was for sale, but wasn't there also, aren't you also challenging some testimony by the police officer that the street value of the marijuana was a certain amount? And didn't Escobar specifically testify about the what this either was or could have been sold for? So why isn't that cumulative?
Well, it's a different amount they each testified to, for one thing. And the reason it's not cumulative is because you have a damaged person up there testifying. He's been impeached with his own statements to the police. The people need to reinforce the street value, and they put on improper evidence that is, as you say, it's from a policeman. It's not questionable as they presented it. So it is actually giving in testimony that previously was damaged. It's not cumulative. It's extremely helpful and essential to the police's case, to the prosecution's case. All right? So I would ask that it be reversed because of the police expert, and I do not. And it was also harmful error because it went because of just what I explained, that the only other thing they had on the street value came from an witness whose testimony was at issue. It is proper that it went to the jury. That's established Colorado law. But it was highly incredible when you looked at it versus his impeachment. But it was not as a matter of law.
Street value, an element of the offense? It was a conspiracy to distribute, right?
Yes.
Does it make a difference how much the value is of what he's distributing?
It seems to be inferred in the argument raised below, but now that you raise it, I don't think it is.
It's harmless error, isn't it?
Well, wouldn't the street value of the marijuana make more likely the element of intent to distribute? If it's worth a lot of money, then that's more likely that it was for the purposes of distribution.
That is true, and it also is true that Mr. Escobar said, I intended to sell it for. as opposed to, this is what I paid and this is what it's worth to me.
Relevance is in support of that element. But as I understand your argument, that element was not contested by your client. Your client really essentially admitted that there's a certain amount of marijuana, it's for resale, et cetera, et cetera. It's just his view was, or his position was, I didn't know about it. I wasn't in on it. His defense centered on mens rea.
Right, knowledge.
So
and intent.
So in some ways, all this disputed evidence that you're talking about really goes to elements that were not challenged at trial.
No, because the conspiracy also includes intended to do it. And did he intend to be in a car with the person that was going to sell? That was one of the issues the jury is looking at. So I think it does. I think it goes to the conspiracy, and that the jury had questions about the conspiracy also leads to this being harmful and not harmless. And that goes to the jury instructions requested by the defendant at the close of trial, in which he asked that constructive possession be further elaborated under the unique facts developed in this particular case. And in this particular case, he asked that Phelps be used to explain that just because you are in the area of drugs, if you don't have dominion in possession, it's not necessarily a matter of inference that you own it. And it was totally proper under this case, especially based on the jury instructions that came going, I believe it was, does failure to act based on knowledge constitute conspiracy? And what their question clearly was going to is if he could smell the pot in the car, should he have jumped out of the car? Should he have done something to stop the conspiracy? And the instruction did not properly instruct them on how to do that. It did not, possession didn't take them far enough to help the jury. And this is one of the issues that I enjoy reading the People's Brief very much about our 1993 Colgis, because our Colgis are not tracking our, in criminal law, not tracking our statutes as much, and they're not reflecting the change in case law. So we are required now to adjust the Colgi to match our cases and the facts that come in. And Phelps was appropriate in this case, and it was harmful error in this case to not instruct the jury that what dominion and constructive possession meant.
Instructions. Could you explain to me exactly what you suggest the defendant's tendered refused instruction added to the standard instruction in terms of knowledge?
Just a second, Your Honor.
Quoted page 16 of your opening brief, and theirs is quoted page 8 of their brief.
At this point, I am withdrawing my argument on temporary handling of a drug. I'm not going to be arguing that. Okay? I couldn't find case law to support the Berry argument in that. I'm not withdrawing it as a matter of law, but I'm just not going to argue that. On the important instruction, it goes to the exclusive possession and where a controlled substance is found, mere presence, the word is mere presence. And that is the word that comes up in many of these cases where you have a controlled substance that nobody has actual control of. And mere presence has not been addressed in the Colgi. Mere presence is what needed to be added. Mere presence is that you are merely there. And that does go into the Felt case, which involved the people in the house and all of the various issues that happened there. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Gowdy. You've got about a minute and 20 seconds for rebuttal.
Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Clemmy Engel. The registration number is 6686, and I'm appearing for the people in this appeal. At the outset, just to make sure that we're properly organized on the defendant's claims, as I see it, he's got two different convictions. He's got two claims on each conviction, which, in my view, apply only to that conviction. So there's a conviction for possession. There's a sufficiency of the evidence claim as to that, which I perceive as not close. There's the jury instruction claim as to that conviction, which I perceive as not close. And then there is a conspiracy to distribute conviction, there's a sufficiency of the evidence claim as to that conviction, which I perceive as somewhat closer. And then, of course, there's the opinion testimony claim, which I think is the most interesting claim in the case, and that's the one I plan to talk chiefly about. Concerning the defendant's, the detective's testimony that the, that 7 pounds of marijuana is an amount for resale, the critical language is from the Roethlisberger case, as quoted from Utah, as quoted in our Barron case, and that is that the question deals with the common juror's ability to identify whether a particular quantity of an illegal substance is so large that it would likely be used for future sale. And then that case goes on to say that by definition, the only persons having such knowledge would be those who are either involved in the sale of illegal substances or who are involved in law enforcement. And we have some third degree of case law precedent saying that that is so with respect to methamphetamine and rock cocaine. But I do not think that that's a valid statement as to all illegal drugs categorically, and especially marijuana. And just look at the culture. I submit that your everyday average layperson is at least passingly familiar with the dosages and quantities of marijuana. Very large percentage of laypersons know what a joint is, know what a toke is, what a bowl is, how far an ounce goes, and that a pound is a whole lot. And I submit that, importantly, in terms of the Roethlisberger and Barron decisions in cases like that, you don't need to be a drug dealer or a law enforcement officer to know that. References are rife in the common culture, and it's hard to grow up without being exposed to that. I also think it's interesting, perhaps, that with the advent of medical marijuana, which I suppose makes marijuana not entirely illegal drug in this state, any citizen can go online and see the price menus for various marijuana products at various dispensaries, and that citizen will see prices quoted in terms of grams or fractions of ounces and not in terms of multiple pounds. So those are some of the reasons why marijuana stands in contrast to methamphetamine and rock cocaine for purposes of this analysis. I also have found, I think somewhat surprisingly, have found no precedent which deals with this issue one way or the other. Perhaps it's out there and the court's research is better than mine, but in the absence of precedent, the deeper question I have and what bothers me or interests me about this case is, how do judges decide what is and what is not within the everyday knowledge of a common juror? And I've really found no satisfactory answer to that question, because when I look at the cases that are cited in the briefs that make conclusory statements that the average citizen knows little about methamphetamine manufacture or quantities of rock cocaine, I see no Gallup polls in support of that conclusion. I see no empirical data in support of that conclusion. So I can only conclude that in reaching conclusions of this sort in the Rule 701 context, that judges have to rely on their common sense and life experience and broad knowledge of the culture. And I think if you do that in the case of marijuana, it's hard to reach the same conclusion here as you would reach in Barron with respect to methamphetamine.
Other than the objection at trial and the court's ruling, overruling the objection, was there any substantive argument along the lines that you're just suggesting right now at trial on this issue? In other words, did they engage in any kind of an argument before the court on this issue of what an ordinary person would know or not know?
Not that I recall. My recollection is that the officer did give testimony that would strike one as the beginning of the foundations to qualify an expert under Rule 702. For example, the detectives testified, oh yeah, I've been to DEA school, I've learned about drugs and so forth. And then he was asked to give his, he was asked whether this would be an amount for resale, defense counsel objected that he ought to be qualified as an expert, and the judge said no, he can give that as lay opinion testimony based on his experience as a detective. So no, we didn't get this kind of discussion in the trial court. I think I don't think it was error to admit this as lay opinion testimony, but assuming that it was, without expressly qualifying this detective as an expert, then I have two answers to that. Number one is I think he was impliedly qualified, as our case law recognizes as a possibility, by the trial judges saying, well, he can give that opinion based on his experience and training. And in any event, I would think any error here would be harmless because it was cumulative of Mr. Escobar's testimony that he was going to sell or distribute the drugs. And we don't have any evidence here that the defense was hampered either in its preparation or in its argument of its theory. And we have a contrast here to the Verum case, where there was a problem with a lack of notice and preparation on expert witness issues. Here, we didn't have the defense arguing prejudice or protesting in the trial court that I didn't have time to prepare to counter this expert opinion testimony. And in any event, the defense was simply that the defendant had nothing to do with it. The defense wasn't that I'm a Rastafarian or a Costco shopper and I was letting this amount in for my personal use.
Strikes me in some of these cases that I don't understand is why don't the people just list the detective as an expert and say he's going to come in, he's going to testify to the street value, he's going to testify to the resale element, and he's qualified to do so because you just told us he has all these qualifications. Why don't they just do that and avoid these arguments, because we see them all the time?
I don't know. That's a good suggestion.
Okay, I've made it.
Actually, that was a suggestion in Verum, and apparently it hasn't taken yet.
It may be something to mention at the next District Attorney's Council conference. And another interesting thing here is if it does come in as lay opinion testimony, to echo Judge Russell's question, the lay opinion is almost redundant of what the common juror would know. If a lay opinion is within the realm of a common juror's knowledge, then isn't it redundant? Let's just take the common example of testimony that somebody's drunk. You have testimony, objective fact. Were the person's eyes bloodshot? Yes, that's an objective fact. But was the person's speech slurred? Yes, that's an objective fact. Was the person staggering? Yes, that's an objective fact. Okay, what's your lay opinion based on that as to whether the person was drunk or not? Well, my opinion was he was drunk. Well, that's admissible lay opinion, but if every common person could draw that conclusion anyhow, perhaps the punchline is a bit redundant of common experience.
Let me ask you a question about your harmlessness argument. And you talked about, well, he was the detective was essentially qualified here anyway, so he was implicitly qualified. Is there any Colorado case that says that's enough for harmlessness? Because it seems to me if that's enough, then it wipes out the whole theory behind Stewart and Verum and the idea that, you know, if you've got an expert and you're trying to get expert testimony out of him, you've got to follow the rules. It seems to me that if you have somebody who's actually qualified, but there's no prejudice or it's cumulative, then maybe you've got a pretty good argument about harmlessness. But just to say that, well, the expert was implicitly qualified takes away any error here. Is there any case that says that? Because that seems to me counterintuitive.
There's at least one case, the Malloy case cited at page 21 of my brief. The difference there...
Yeah, but there you had cumulativeness as well.
Well, the difference there is that in Malloy, it was held that it was no plain error were not to expressly qualify him where he was amply qualified, which I think would be the case here. I mean, it's in the record that our detective here was amply qualified, I think. But any assessment of plain error or harmless error necessarily has to proceed on a fact-specific case-by-case basis. So the difference between a plain error and a harmless error case, obviously, is that when a proper objection was made, I've got the burden to show harmless error instead of the defendant having the burden to demonstrate plain error. But we've got nothing in the record here indicating in the least that this particular defendant was prejudiced. If he had had a different theory of the case, or if he had made a record that, oh, if I had known this, I would have had my own expert at the ready to testify that 7 pounds is commonly an amount for personal use, then maybe we would have a different ballgame, but we don't.
Which was the case in Varon. In the Varon case, you had a record that made that kind of argument.
That's what I'm saying. In Varon's case, there was a record the defendant was prejudiced by non-disclosure in advance of the expert witness. We don't have that record here.
Almost definitionally in Malloy, you don't have it because there was no objection in the first place, let alone an offer that we were surprised by this and could have met it had it been timely disclosed through an expert disclosure.
True. Unless the court has questions for further questions on this issue or questions about any of the other issues, that's all I have.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
Scotty suggests that the element of mere presence is missing from the form jury instruction on possession. What do you have to say about that? You heard her argument, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, if her argument is that the standard instruction on possession does not impart that notion that mere presence is not sufficient, I would disagree. The standard instruction covers that by using terms he has to. Well, here, let me just read it. The language is a bit archaic and cumbersome, but it requires that he actually knew of the presence of the object and that he exercised actual physical control or immediate knowing dominion or control over it. Now, that certainly requires more than mere presence without knowledge of the presence without exercise of dominion or control. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engel. Ms. Gowdy, you've got about a minute and 17 seconds.
The people here are arguing basically cumulative harmless error for everything that went wrong in this case. The people failed to endorse an expert. Oops, it's okay, let in 702 testimony is 701. The people's testimony was insufficient to survive a judgment of acquittal. Oops, reasonable doubt doesn't apply to the judgment of acquittal standard. It clearly does. The judge on the record said it didn't. Mere presence was requested to clarify what is, as the people put, a very archaic possession statement. Phelps has adapted it that is an acceptable term of law. Oops, it doesn't matter. When you put it all together, the prejudice came out is that a very weak case convicted this man, and he should not have been convicted, particularly under the testimony of his uncle, of his nephew in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.